is item number 6, State Wildlife Action Plan Revision Process. This is a briefing. Eric Gardner and Lynn Helbrecht, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and Commissioners, Director Anderson and Joe. Thank you very much for inviting us here today and letting us have some of your very valuable time. And as Madam Chair Recker indicated, we're here to talk about the State Wildlife Action Plan and its revision. I'm in a fortunate position where I've got some staff that I've brought on that's really in charge of that project, so I get to turn the microphone over to Lynn Helbrecht. Lynn is kind of on loan to us in the wildlife program from the Habitat program, where she does a lot of climate change work, and I think many of you are familiar with her from that. But she's working with us through the completion of this project, and she'll be presenting the topic, and I'll chime in on a couple of the slides with some additional information.
Great. Thank you, Eric, and good morning, all. Today we wanted to do a few things. We wanted to give you a brief overview of the State Wildlife Action Plan, why we're doing it, what it is, highlight a few of the key elements related to some of the content and give you a flavor of the substance of it, and importantly, talk about how we plan to engage some of our conservation partners and stakeholders. So to begin, what is the State Wildlife Action Plan? This program began in 2001. At that time, Congress established a new program called the State Wildlife Grants Program. And it was an opportunity to direct funding towards wildlife conservation, and importantly, the aim was to get funding to species before they became endangered, so to get out ahead of listings. And it was a big win for conservation at the time to have that new source of funding, but it didn't come without strings. The other part of that legislation was that states have to have a state wildlife action plan approved by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in order to be eligible for those grants. And it started this big program of producing these, and the first action plans were due in 2005, and at that time they were called Comprehensive Wildlife Conservation Strategies. Washington completed ours. It's on our website still, along with all the other states, so all 50 states have an approved action plan. They require updating every 10 years, and so our update is due in October of this year, 2015. Just to note that the State Wildlife Action Plan doesn't trigger SEPA because it's sort of misnamed in a way an action plan. It's really more of a conservation blueprint. We talk about it as a vehicle that informs other planning processes, and any actions we would end up taking through the grant process would need to be approved by the feds. So a little bit more about the State Wildlife Grants funding and how much we get and where the funding goes. Eric, talk through that.
Thank you, Lynn. Yes, the department receives approximately $1 million a year through this program, but it's not guaranteed by any means. It's subject to appropriation. You were just handed a summary of the total funding that's come to the state through that program. I apologize, it didn't go with your packet originally. It was intended to. But you can see the full history there of the funding that's come to the state for wildlife conservation as a result of this. And you can see it's unfortunately the very last page doesn't give you the state along with the column or the row there, but four up from the bottom is Washington. And we've received just shy of $16 million since the inception of this program that's led to conservation in the state. We use that it requires a match, and over the years the match ratio has changed a little bit, but it's kind of settled on a 65-35, so 65% federal and 35% from state funds. So this is a great matchup with our personalized license plate funds, and so that money combined, at least in the diversity division, really constitutes the lion's share of the funding for our wildlife diversity program and the work we do across the state with those species. The diversity division is not the only division to receive the funds. There is a portion that goes to the fisheries program and another portion that goes to the habitat program, although this program is really designed for the diversity work that a state agency does, so wildlife diversity and the wildlife program do receive the majority of it, about 70%, 20% to fisheries and 10% to the habitat program, with a piece of that helps out in the director's office. And I believe that covers it. Thank you.
Commissioner Smith?
Just a quick question. Is the allocation based on a state's population?
The allocation, let me think about this. We have so many different ones. It's based on size and population and number of listed species, and then there's a
number
formula
that's
applied.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
So we know that we have to do this plan, that it's required to be eligible for the state wildlife grant funding, but we also have found it helpful to be very explicit about the other values that this plan gives us so that we can make sure that we are building it and constructing it in a way that we're going to get some leverage out of it and get the maximum value. So it can also be influential in securing other funding. Other organizations, foundations, private interests have made alignment with state wildlife action plans. So, for example, if someone's applying for a grant, they get extra points if the species are in the state wildlife action plan or the habitats are indicated. So it's a way to leverage that funding. We can also, it's a way to think about advancing our conservation priorities in the department with our conservation partners because of that, because they're able to, in some cases, secure other funding with the species that are in the plan, and it also is a very public document, so it's a way for us to be very upfront about what we see as the conservation priorities. It also creates an opportunity for us to align better internally, do a little bit more of our homework, and about a year and a half ago, we set up a cross-program team that has been meeting monthly and advising us as we prepare this plan to make sure we have full input from the Habitat and the Fish program as well as the Wildlife program. And because all the states have to do this plan and there are certain elements that are the same, it really creates sort of a common language, if you will, a common framework. And so it's really an opportunity for us to facilitate partnership with some of our border states and beyond. And I just star those last two because we're already starting to see some good value, I think, out of some conversations that have been happening for those two opportunities. So that's sort of why we're doing it, and the bottom line really is that we are want to ensure that our product meets the guidelines and the requirements set up by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, but also that it's relevant and it will add value to the work of the agency. So what is it that we really have to do? The service sets up 8 essential elements that we must conduct as part of the plan. They don't necessarily tell us how to do it, but they tell us what to do. They do give some guidance. The first is to identify the distribution and status of species of greatest conservation need, and that really drives a lot of the rest of the plan. We need to also identify the extent and condition of habitats that are necessary for these species' survival. We need to discuss the problems and key threats that affect SGCN, as we call them, and their habitats, and then determine and prioritize actions to conserve these species and their habitat. It's a big bunch of work. It really represents the heart of the plan, and we're deep into this work at this moment. There are also a few other elements. We need to discuss monitoring and adaptive management, talk about how we plan to keep the plan current. And the last two deal with a focus on working with our conservation partners and the public. And the service makes a big point of this, and in some of the workshops they've had for the plan coordinators, these are really stressed, and there really is an interest in making sure that we are reaching out to both partners and stakeholders in the public. So I want to talk a little bit about this first part I mentioned, the species of greatest conservation need, which really, as I said, is sort of the heart of the plan. It's intended to include both species which already have conservation status, as well as those which may be in rapid decline. And one of the sort of mantras of the first time this plan came around was keep common species common. And as I mentioned, it's really an opportunity to try and bring a little more conservation attention and funding to some of the species that might be on the edge before they become listed. And I want to walk you through our criteria, just because this is kind of an important part of the plan. And so we have, of course, an existing SGCN list, and right now, in the last month, we've been revising that list, and we adopted somewhat different criteria to generate our list this time. So there were two primary criteria that drive whether or not a species is going to be considered a species of greatest conservation need or not. The first is that it has some legal status. It's either federally listed or state listed. So it's gone through some process already to say, hey, this critter's in trouble. And just to clarify that a little bit, Eric wanted to
Thank you, Lynn. It's Madam Chair and Commission. I'm not really sure how familiar all of you are with some of the state regulations regarding how we would classify our wildlife into either a sensitive, threatened, or endangered species status, and that's sort of the all falls under that category of state listed. And I didn't want to derail this topic of conversation today, but I wanted to let you know that we are on your agenda in February, and we plan to present more information about that whole legal process, because we will be presenting to you, it'll be a public hearing for a proposed delisting of Stellar Sea Lion and a proposed listing of Tufted Puffin. And these types of actions, we really haven't been in front of you for a very long time to take any of those actions. So we're looking forward to that meeting, and we'll walk you through the process and the steps and the legal ramifications of that, and then have that public hearing, and then your decision is in March on those two items.
Commissioner Smith.
Another quick question. For the status, would something, if a critter was listed like on the red list for the IUCN, would that have any bearing, or is that not?
Madam Chair, Commissioner Smith, yes, it certainly could. I don't believe we ended up with the IUCN being a driver, but we looked at some very similar methodology in our heritage data management, and I think Lynn's going to perhaps touch a little bit on that. So we looked at what's called S rankings, global rankings, state rankings, all very much associated with that whole process. So we did evaluate that.
So following right along, so these two primary criteria was, one, it has some legal status. Secondly, that the animal has a high conservation concern. And we used a couple of different ways to determine that. One was we looked at the work we had done in 2005 and pulled those species that had a high conservation concern then back into our pool. Secondly, alluding to what Eric just shared, we used a national system called NatureServe to identify whether it was globally imperiled or state imperiled, and we said those who had a high ranking, we'll stick them on our first pass through. And the advantage is we were encouraged to use that list because it's nationally consistent. So again, it sort of creates this common language across the states. So that's what we started with. But then, and I think there were 300 odd species or whatever that were in that pool, and then anything below that would be not a species of greatest conservation need. We also recognize that there are a lot of reasons that we, Washington, might not want to spend attention on a species that has high conservation needs. So it could be peripheral to the state. It could be only an occasional visitor. It could be that we might be at the very end, the very southern end or the northern end of that species range, so it doesn't make sense for us to spend conservation attention. And so we pulled a number of species out, or we're in the process of doing that from our pool. And similarly, there may be very good reasons for pulling a species back up. Maybe those 2005 rankings were a little out of date, and so we've been working very hard with our regional and our headquarters biologists and some folks outside of the agency to vet our list, to make sure we have current status, and it's been a great process. We've really refreshed our understanding of the status of a lot of species through this process. And we're not quite ready to share with you our new list because we're still doing this vetting. But this is what, so you get a flavor for it. This is what the old list looks like in terms of the breakdown here. We probably have more species on the list because we did our criteria a bit different. And we had, for example, a lot more robust participation from the fish program. So we'll have more fish on our list. And it will look a little bit different. And one thing to note about this list is that because a species is on this list doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get funding from the department. It means it's eligible for funding, and we will prioritize this list. We can prioritize this list in any number of ways. If we are, for example, prioritizing species for funding for state wildlife grants, we might look at a different set of criteria. If we're looking for citizen science projects, we might prioritize in a different way. Or we have opportunities for research partnerships with universities, we might look at a different way. So we can chat more about that in a moment. And sort of an early view here, at least in our current list right now, these species are proposed to be dropped from that 2005 list. In some cases, a couple cases, it's the result of a taxonomic change, but in many cases, there's improved status of these species, and so we want to be able to tell a good story when we can about conservation. Amendment to this list, and under mammals, you see the Pacific Harbor Porpoise. That actually is going to be, it shouldn't be on that list. We moved it back onto SGCN, so wanted to bring that to your attention. And also new this time, we want to include a climate watch list. So we have been partnering with a number of organizations around the state to create a species sensitivity database. And we'll pull from that to identify a list of species that are highly sensitive to climate change. And again, this will just give us a chance to highlight how climate change may be affecting, you know, some of the species we care about in the state, and also start to tee up what some of these monitoring projects might be for science programs or whatnot. So, we have a little bit of funding from an outside organization to help us build that list. So, once we have our list, and we're sort of doing some of this work now, we need to, as you might remember from those eight essential elements, talk about the status and distribution of the species, the extent of habitats, and the threats and actions, which are really the key part. What are we going to do differently about to address the needs for these species? And so just to give you a flavor about what our content will look like, we've been preparing fact sheets for each of our SGCN. And so this is an example for the Washington ground squirrel, and really, we're aiming for 2 pages, which is a very difficult thing for a biologist to do, to just get things down to 2 pages. But we want to summarize the conservation concern for the animal, talk about the biology and life history, particularly as it pertains to its conservation challenges, and then habitat needs and distribution of abundance. Due diligence for that first page. And then the second page is really probably more important, and that's where we start to lay out what we see as the specific threats and the conservation actions that are needed. So for each threat we identify, and these will be fairly high level, right, in this kind of a broad scale document, we'll have a specific action associated with that threat. And then new this year is we're also identifying where the agency has a lead role to play in that particular action, or where our external partners may have a lead role, or where we share a lead role. So this will start to let us be able to sort and identify where we might want to put more attention towards some actions over others. And we're also going to include a little section where we have data on the climate sensitivity of that species.
Commissioner Holtzmiller?
Again, people can call a lot of animals a lot of different names, but how could a person find out about this Washington ground squirrel? I mean, what it truly is, because we've got a lot of them around that we call ground squirrels. Yeah, they're threatened on my place because they come around the house and make a hell of a mess, and I shoot them. So, where can a person go to see what is...
Yep. Madam Chair and Commissioners, we have a lot of great resources right on our very own website that help with identification of the different species and subspecies of these. We can certainly provide, in many cases, even brochures and documentation. We have a pretty good document on the different squirrels found within the state, and they do some of that description. And it's not always that easy. And, you know, Washington ground squirrel is actually proposed for federal listing. It's part of the multi-district litigation that's currently underway for settlement. So it's good to know the difference, and so we can certainly help you, and we hope to help the public with that. We also put out our status report. It's not necessarily annual. Our last one was in 2012, but it's an update on the status of our state and federally listed species that occur, and it's a PDF that you've been provided for before, and that's available online, and it also gives you a lot of really good factual information about those species in about 3 to 4 pages of detail. And if there's something else we could help you with, be happy to provide it.
One of the challenges I think that's on us as the preparers of the plan is to make sure that we're not just creating a lot of information about these species, but that we're really kind of doing our work to prioritize action. So that's kind of our next phase of work with us.
You got another quick question.
Yeah, yeah.
When these fact sheets all get developed, that's a pretty educational tool. And I just, what the distribution plan, I mean, I could see those going to all AP environmental science courses around the state or something like that. You know, I hope it has widespread distribution because I think it's very, very informative.
Particularly, I think, about some of the species that we know less about. It's really an opportunity to sort of build our knowledge about that. So I want to talk just briefly about another product that we will be including for many of our SGCN. And we didn't have spatial distribution information about the species in our last plan. So for probably about 80 of our SGCN, we'll be including habitat distribution and range maps. And we're using kind of a new methodology to generate these, and we're only able to do them for the species that we have enough information on. But they are based on verified occurrences, and then also the Habitat Association of Species. And so it allows us to create kind of a standard way of looking at range and distribution across a number of species, possibly layer maps on each other, and be able to prioritize and target restoration and share with our partners. And I've chatted about this with a couple of outside folks, and there seems to be a lot of interest in having a tool like this that we can all kind of consult. Yeah.
Director Henderson?
So, Lynn, in this particular spatial distribution is reflective of Washington ground squirrel.
Yeah, so this is an example for the Washington ground squirrel.
And, so the white areas are areas where they are not normally found?
Correct.
Is that right?
So the
area down in the deep southeast part of the state looks like it's white and doesn't look like there's many down there in the deep southeast portion of the state. So I'm thinking maybe the squirrels.
And there's none down there.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was hoping to see.
Madam Chair, Director Anderson, that's correct. And I don't know that Lynn was prepared to go into a lot of detail, but that's a fairly busy-looking map. And what those are hydrological unit codes, and so it's the way that you can look at a landscape based on watersheds, and there's different sizes. You can think the littlest trickle of stream being one level, and the Columbia River being, you know, very large. So what we have here is polygons essentially tied to HUC 10 and HUC 12 size, and so that's why the map looks so busy, and that's what all of those different polygons are.
And the different colors on the map represent different habitats that the species may be to a greater degree or lesser degree associated with. So depending on what color the map is, you have a greater or lesser chance of finding the species there if you're doing surveys or something like that. So I want to just talk briefly about habitats. If you remember from those 8 essential elements, we need to not only talk about the species of greatest conservation need, but also the habitats they depend on. And we're just building this part of the plan. We're a little less further along here. Our work is to identify 10 to 15 or possibly a few more priority types. So these would be things like shrub steppe, near shore, fairly large categories that are important for a number of species. And then similar to these fact sheets that we have been preparing for our species, we want to be able to do fact sheets for each of these habitat types. What's the distribution in abundance? Which SGCN are associated with these habitats? What's their degree of imperilment? What are the top threats and actions? And lead roles for either the agency or our partners. Once we have that, we also want to, those will be more conceptual habitat types, like shrub steppe appears in many places around the state, or riparian landscapes. We want to talk about priority landscapes, actual places on the ground within these habitat types or containing these habitat types that are ripe for conservation. And so this is related to an initiative within the department that I think you'll be getting more information on in the next meeting or two, where we're trying to use this as a place to coalesce support for conservation on the ground. And so we want to the extent we can, include that within our State Wildlife Action Plan. And then all the way down to the district level. So values that are important for these SGCN, these particular habitat types at the district level, will help guide our acquisition, for example, or conservation work at a district level. Can you say anything more about that?
Oh, thank you, Lynn. Just very quickly, the priority landscapes that Lynn referenced, we are currently on your February agenda to bring that topic to you as well and start that discussion about where we might want to identify that place-based prioritization across the state.
So finally, the last piece is just a little bit about our outreach and engagement. And our goal here is meaningful and cost-effective outreach, and I italicize those because we don't have a lot of resources for this plan, and so we need to make sure that the outreach we do is going to be effective. We have been working with the Wildlife Diversity Advisory Council and making regular presentations to that group, and we developed an outreach plan that they endorsed, as well as our cross-program team. To date, we've updated our website. I've mentioned we've been briefing the council, and we took a big step last month. We sent out a broadcast email to pretty much everybody we could think of that might have an interest in this plan and let them know that that they should be in touch if they want to be kept in the loop and hear about workshops and drafts, be able to review drafts and whatnot. So we have planned, I guess I can put a check by that first bullet there. Our formal outreach is really sort of launched with this presentation to you, so thank you for the opportunity. In February, we have three workshops planned to introduce some of our draft products. This will be introducing our draft SGC list and some of the actions and getting some feedback at an early enough stage that we can actually incorporate considerations and thoughts into the development of the plan itself. So that's kind of an important piece. In March, we're identifying key folks that we want to make sure we talk to. We don't rely on them to come to us, but we'll offer to come to them because we think it's so important to have their endorsement or buy-in or at least awareness of this plan. And I think those are going to be probably more effective than the workshops. We'll see. But it's a chance to make sure that we've kind of covered our bases. And then our goal is in June to have a draft document available for a more formal public review. And broadcast email I mentioned, these an example of the sectors that we included to try and make sure that we were casting a pretty wide net and making sure anyone who might be interested had a chance to weigh in.
Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, Lynn, just to add to it again on that list, I would put the state chapter for the National Science Teachers Association or something like that, because I think this would be very receptive in a high school venue because it can be localized to their area, and I think it would be a good tool. And also, you probably have, but talk to Margaret Tudor, I think, would be a nice link in all of this, too, for citizen science.
I think that's our brief overview, and happy to take questions unless Eric
wants to talk. Good. What a nice job. I mean, I loved how crisp that presentation was. That was really excellent. Team approach. Wonderful. And it is a good news story. You know, a lot of good work being done. Big tent, lots of partners. When does the diversity group get together, the diversity advisory group?
Our next meeting, Madam Chair, is February 28th here in Olympia. And they've actually expressed some interest in being here and present, perhaps. I think some of the members are likely to present themselves at February's meeting in the hearing for Stellars and Tufted Puffin. Right. And I think they're looking forward to a little bit more interface and engagement with the commission over the next few years.
That'd be great. Because I remember, I think it was about 2 or 3 years ago, the meetings coincided, the commission meeting and the diversity advisory group meeting. So that was nice seeing people there.
Great. I will let them know that, and we'll see what we can do to schedule so that we can have a little bit of overlap. Thank you.
Great. Okay. Any comments from anyone? Well, it's I am kind of interested in the general habitat, priority habitats concept. Now, I've heard over and over and over about shrub step, and those are over on the other side of the state. So what are the big picture priority habitats on the west side of the state?
Madam Chair, so certainly, where we're thinking current areas of focus would be both the prairie grasslands here in the South Sound with the recent listing of three prairie-related species, Taylor checkerspot, pocket gopher, streaked hornlark. It's a relatively small habitat patch, so your concept or everybody's individual definition of what a landscape is, you kind of have to allow yourself to shrink it down a little bit to call that a landscape, but it can be, and it's certainly a high priority for conservation in this area. Our marine ecosystem and the watersheds that feed it, both for spawning salmonids and, of course, just the value they provide to a lot of our diverse species in the state, terrestrial and avian as well. You could look at a forested and oak ecosystem and western gray squirrel as an example. So those are the things that we're considering. Of course, it's easy to describe quickly wall-to-wall coverage of the entire state and not prioritize. So our desire, this plan will talk about needs in all of those areas, and the district values will explain what we can address across the state wall-to-wall coverage. But the concept of priority landscapes, we're asking ourselves, do we know enough at this time? Should we be able to call out, say, 3 to 5 places in the state that when we have a choice and we have to choose where we might direct resources, we might want to go there instead of somewhere else? And that's what that concept, that's what that discussion will be about. And we're hoping that we can do it just so that we can come together, at least within the wildlife program, hopefully for the agency, and understand where those places are across the state.
Commissioner Holtzmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there again, back to the map. That was the area that you said that your type of ground squirrels were at. They aren't on down in my part of the world, right?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. Well, and why I got a little revved up about the deal is two friends of mine, one of them was with the pygmy rabbits, and they had owned that place for a lot of years. And the management they had applied kept the rabbits alive. And then all of a sudden, they were told how they were going to manage it and do this, that, and the other. Another one is a friend of mine, lives down the Klickitat area, and that place has been in the family 100-plus years. And very good stewards of the land. And they had the gray squirrels on their place. Well, then all of a sudden, they had been logging for 100-plus years. And the management that they've done, they had plenty of squirrels. But the minute they wanted to start hitting another, when the gray squirrel issue came up, well, now you can't log on your place. And it became counterproductive because it was a pretty big income for them. And pretty quick it was, well, we see a squirrel, we know what to do, because if we shoot the squirrel, they come out and they can't find the squirrel. That becomes counterproductive. Right. And when you get people that have been on these places for all these years and they still have them, we really want to watch how we deal with people to where we don't come in with a heavy hand. And we want to acknowledge that, you know, evidently they must be doing something right or they still wouldn't have the squirrels.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Holtzmiller, we certainly have our conservation obligations, but I'm here to tell you that I'm a firm believer in working very hard to bring what we call landowner incentive tools to Washington, in particular where there's the potential for a federal listing. And some of the things you'll hear coming out of my shop here over the next year or two. So example, for the pygmy rabbit one, we did have what's called a safe harbor agreement program in place. It's still in place. And if there are landowners who have that concern, we can easily sign them into a safe harbor agreement, which kind of gives them a baseline. It makes management and continued practices on the land easy, and they receive their protections, and they won't be worried about a potential federal take issue with that species. Similarly, you'll be hearing from us in the future about plans to continue our efforts for fisher and fisher reintroductions in the state. Not a federally listed species, but could be. It's currently being reviewed. So we're developing a program that falls under the Candidate Conservation Agreement with Assurances. And the whole purpose there is, here's a subset of, in this case, fairly easy conservation measures that if a landowner agrees to and abides to, such as if there's an important den site, they wouldn't cut it down during denning season, and perhaps some access to document reproduction, just some small things like that. They can sign on to that and receive assurances, in other words, a 10A/1B permit from the Fish and Wildlife Service, and wouldn't be in jeopardy of take again for that species. A little bit more complicated because there are some significant habitat conservation concerns, but with sage grouse, we're in the process of developing a candidate conservation agreement with assurances for sage grouse management in the state. So, you know, I know we still have our conservation obligations as a state, and we need to be looking out for these species, but I'm here to tell you and commit to you that we're trying to do that in the best way possible, looking out for landowners and their use of the land, and looking to these federal tools wherever possible to put them to use.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Well said. Thank you both.